Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
This morning, we got to talk about our sustainability goals. We had a crew of NCBA staff on stage talking about, you know, all of the work that we're doing, and then had a great industry panel where we got to see kind of how those goals are going to help the entire beef supply chain, from the cow-calf producer to the feeder all the way through to the retailer. So really excited about this week. It's been very positive.
Mary Thomas Hart with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
You know, one of the things I always say is the reason I like to work for this industry is because it's so humble. And, you know, our members go out and do their work every day and then go home. But that means that we don't have to, we're not talking about our story enough. So, you know, really my job in DC is just to tell the story of what's happening across the country, and sustainability and, you know, climate change, sustainability, all those conversations give us an excellent opportunity to do that.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I'm really in the thick of this conversation for the administration and with the Chinese.
Ambassador Sarah Bianchi, Deputy U.S. Trade Representative, speaking at the Washington International Trade Association's International Trade Conference on dealing with China. And one of the biggest questions is, how do we move forward as the Phase One agreement comes to an end?
And you're, of course, right that China fell short on its phase one commitments. And we've been actively engaging in discussions. And I have specifically with my counterpart in Beijing on this matter. And so very attuned to this issue. You know, we're trying to create, this is a really important relationship. We're trying to create a stable relationship, but it's also a difficult one. And we're in a difficult stage in the relationship. To be super candid, the conversations are not easy. They're very difficult, but, you know, but from my perspective, what's important is we're having conversations, and they will be unflinchingly honest. Really clear that the Chinese haven't met their commitment in phase one. That's something we're trying to address. But I also want to emphasize it's clear that China's, state-centered and non-market policies and practices, which were not addressed, in the phase one agreement, are also a serious threat to American economic interests. And we have and will continue to raise these concerns with Beijing as well. And really plan to use the full range of tools we have and develop new tools as needed, to defend our interests.
We also are continuing to see tariffs on Chinese products. What's the future?
Well, I think the way that you have to think about the China relationship is as a holistic economic relationship. And the way that we've thought about it is to really start with looking at the phase one agreement across the board, and particularly around the purchase commitments. Where, you know, as we discussed, China isn't kind of keeping its commitments. We did, as part of that announcement, agree to open an exclusions put in place a process to have some tariff reductions where it's appropriate. And those are kinds of things that we've looked at and could look at in the future. But I think right now the U.S. economy, has a lot going for it. And it's our job to really make sure that we take this holistic approach with China and make sure that we're addressing, you know, all of the different concerns, including some of the non-market economic concerns. So that's kind of the path we'll continue to go down.
So China will not actually hit their commitments for purchases. So what can USTR do?
Well, you know, it's not our goal to escalate here, but certainly we're looking at all of the tools that we have in our toolbox to make sure they're held accountable. The phase one agreement that the prior administration negotiated, you know, has limits in that regard. But we're going to look at all the tools that we have, and both on the phase one commitments, and then also, as I mentioned, some of the other concerns that we have about the non-market economic practices that, you know, are really, you know, these are unfair economic practices that are hurting our businesses. So we're going to look at everything available to us.
And while not.
Ambassador Sarah Bianchi, Deputy U.S. Trade Representative. It's Agriculture Today.
When it comes to farming cotton in West Texas, The formula for success is simple. Put strong in, get strong out. That's why growers rely on Delta Pine brand cotton. Bred, tested, and made in West Texas for West Texas growing conditions. Strong is a legacy all its own. Protect yours with strong cotton from Delta Pine. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
Success is attained by those who approach problems with a plan and a purpose. As an advocate for High Plains cotton growers since 1956, Plains Cotton Growers has been tackling the tough issues facing cotton growers through beneficial legislative and regulatory changes. An important part of PCG's success is through close working relationships with congressional representatives and federal regulatory staff, allowing cotton growers more time to devote to farming operations. From the halls of Congress to the dusty turnroads of the High Plains, cotton producers depend on Plains Cotton Growers.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Agronomists at Kansas State University have embarked on a new study of what they're calling the carbon intensity of grain sorghum production. The information they generate may position grain sorghum more favorably as a feedstock for ethanol production. K-State environmental quality agronomist Peter Tomlinson discusses the goal of this project, which is being supported by a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy. He says that this comprehensive, large-scale research project will collect data on grain sorghum and its carbon footprint.
The goal of this project is to collect crop production data at the farm level to understand what all the inputs are, as well as the carbon stocks in the soil and the greenhouse gas emissions that come out of sorghum production.
Tomlinson identifies the sampling that will be done to collect information on what the carbon intensity score would be for that location.
We are collaborating with a local producer, currently got this year 81 acres instrumented, and when I say that, it means we've got a tower in the center of the field that has instrumentation to collect soil moisture, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane emissions, as well as different readings on the growing crop, on understand, you know, how the crop is performing throughout the year. And then in addition to that, we collect soil samples throughout the growing season. We collect plant and soil samples, which will allow us to understand how the crop is utilizing the nutrients in the soil. And the ultimate goal is to have a very comprehensive data set can be used in calculating the carbon intensity value of grain sorghum. And the carbon intensity value is really critical for grain sorghum producers when they go to market that grain sorghum into the ethanol market.
The reason Tomlinson and his team are studying this is that the ethanol industry is expressing an increasing interest in the carbon impact of the feedstocks it uses.
Certainly on the horizon that the ethanol industry will be looking at the carbon intensity score at the farm level. And so having regionally appropriate data is critical to our grain sorghum producers and grain sorghum production in the southern and central plains.
That was K-State environmental quality agronomist Peter Tomlinson on this pioneering work on the carbon intensity of grain sorghum production. I'm Shelby Varner.
So deadline for Arkin PLC is approaching. Gary Schnitke is a University of Illinois ag economist.
Farmers and landowners have till March 15th to change their choices for the 2022-2023 year. If no choices are changed, the decision will revert to what was on that farm for last year. These payments that we're making decisions about, the 2022 year, will be received in October 2023. And just a note here, neither option, ARC, PLC, is likely to make a payment. So pretty much don't sweat the details too much, but again, ARC and PLC are not likely to make a payment in 2022. Another note is that if you want to take SCO, Supplemental Coverage Option, which is a crop insurance product, you have to be enrolled in PLC for that crop.
It's Agriculture Today.
For years, cotton growers have had a trusted partner when it comes to choosing their varieties. NextGen brand cottonseed from America. You can depend on NextGen varieties for performance and yields year after year. And for this year's season, there are several new Bolgard 3 Extend Flex varieties available. Oh, and one other thing. Americott is now offering cotton seed treatments to protect your seed investment against your early season challenges. To find out more, contact your local NextGen representative or seed dealer today. Americott. All we do is cotton. All the time.
The best thing you can put on your crop is your shadow. Your need to be in the field won't change, and the Cotton Research and Promotion Program was put into place to make sure you get the most from every minute you're out there. That's why the Cotton Board and Cotton Incorporated work alongside growers to spur innovation, fund research, and foster sustainability so generations of farming families can walk the same turn rows for years to come. Forever Cotton. Visit cottonboard.org/forevercotton.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We're very interested in pursuing a bilateral agreement with the United Kingdom.
Kent Backus is Senior Director of International Trade and Market Access with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association on new free trade agreements.
You know, a couple of years ago with Brexit, they left the European Union and started negotiating their own trade agreements. They just implemented one with Australia. They implemented another one with New Zealand. But their first choice was the United States. And, you know, unfortunately, with a change in administrations, the current administration hit pause on those negotiations. And so the British weren't going to wait forever. So they started looking for other dance partners and went out and met up with the Australians and the Kiwis. But they really do want a relationship with the U.S. They want a bilateral agreement that's going to encourage trade between our countries. And it's interesting because, you know, we talk about the special relationship with Great Britain, and you know, we have, you know, a very close relationship on security issues and on a whole host of other things, and we're always shoulder to shoulder and aligned. Yet we don't have a trade agreement. And so even though we have a lot of business that flows between our two countries, we don't have a trade agreement that actually fosters that or protects, companies from being subject to, politics. And so, trade agreements are good because, everyone agrees on rules of trade and then allows competition to pursue that. So, we're limited right now. We do have a little bit of access into the UK. But we can only sell 1,000 metric tons annually, and that's 1,000 metric tons under the Hilton quota, which I'm getting really technical on trade nerd speak here, but that means that's your non-hormone treated cattle, but it's also hit with a 20% tariff on top of it. So if you're talking about a really small quota, a high tariff, and a limited production source, there's not a lot of return on investment right now. But you're talking about a British consumer base that loves beef. And they love sophisticated beef. They love beef with a story. They love high-quality beef, and that's exactly what we have.
But earlier this year, TPA, Trade Promotion Authority, ran out on the Biden administration. Doesn't appear that they want it.
I wouldn't say that they're not interested in Trade Promotion Authority. I think because they haven't outright said that, but you know, the lack of movement from Congress on TPA and the administration, I think has been detrimental for a lot of folks in agriculture. We need Trade Promotion Authority because it sets clear guidelines and goals for our negotiators. And it also sends a message to the rest of the world that our negotiators are doing their job with the support of Congress. But having those rules under TPA, under Trade Promotion Authority, it's essential. Now, it is possible to negotiate trade terms outside of that, but it doesn't mean that the end result's going to be very good. It's a very, very risky gamble to take. And I think the best way to do it is to have Congress united with the administration. It's hard to do, but we can unite on science-based trade. We can unite on all of these other priorities and send our negotiators out there to open these markets. But securing a trade agreement with the UK is, I think, in order to do that, we do need Trade Promotion Authority. I think that's going to be fundamental in sending that message.
Kent Backus, Senior Director, International Trade and Market Access with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. It's Agriculture Today.
Every drop counts. Introducing the Patriot 50 Series Sprayer from Case IH that puts every drop of product exactly where you want it. Enhanced LED lights, a cab designed for all-day comfort, and more precise spraying technology. Because just like you, we know every drop counts. Visit your local Wiley implement for details on the new Patriot 50 Series Sprayer.
I'm Scott Wiley. We'll try hard to earn your business, but even harder to keep it. That's it. That's all.
When your field calls for the perfect type of tough, go all in on FiberMax Cotton to deliver the right seed for whatever you're up against. Like the FiberMax 2398 GLTP variety. Strong as an ox, fights like a bull. Built to buck stress, boost yield quality, and stand strong when that verticillium wilt comes creeping. Whether you're looking for that type of tough or another, you can find it at FiberMax.com. FiberMax Cotton Seed from BASF. Always read and follow label directions.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Yeah, back-to-back years of having La Nina, and no years are going to be identical. But we all kind of get that itchy feeling when you hear somebody say La Nina's coming back.
He's the new meteorologist for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and Cattle Facts, Matt Makins, who says we're kind of getting used to La Nina.
If you're in the South or Southwest, your heart sinks a little bit. If you're in the Central Plains and North, you do okay. But then you hear El Nino, and then most people get excited because you're spreading water out to a lot more folks. So we are in back-to-back La Nina years. And when you look at a long-term forecast perspective, we base forecasts on history. So let's go back in history. There have been a lot of years that have been back-to-back La Ninas. That's not necessarily weird. To have a third, you could go back to around 2000, 2001, where we had three La Ninas together. So it's not out of the question. But the good news for me, picking up from Dr. Art where we stand today, is that odds are we do not have a repeat La Nina. Now, I may eat my words, and you could talk to me next year about that. But, you know, the odds are that we're going to see a transition into more favorable weather. And I think that's going to take a long time. But for La Nina to come back a third year, that is hard to do. So we should see conditions get more favorable next fall for a lot of the country. Not one is going to be ideal for everyone, but more ideal considering where the drought has been so prolific with the last two La Ninas.
Obviously, the more near-term the forecast, the more accurate. But what's the longer-range forecast look like?
Most indications, and when I say indications would be like government agencies that forecast the weather around the world. With the exception of the Americans, the NOAA, we all know NOAA, with that exception, everything kind of goes toward neutral, just hangs out near neutral. It may dance between El Nino or La Nina, but generally it's just kind of not making up its mind. Through late January, early February, NOAA modeling indicates La Nina does continue all the way into the fall. But it's an outlier right now. So when you look at the modeling, you have to take a lot into consideration. There's a problem in the weather world when you look at El Nino or La Nina. Those ocean conditions are in the equatorial Pacific, and it's warmer, cold water. Those things don't like to change until you get into our spring. So you get into late February, you get into March, early April. You don't get to that period until you see the ocean start to change. So they're doing what they want right now. They're just hanging out. So look toward March and April for all the forecast modeling to become much more accurate, because you're starting to see the oceans evolve at that point. Until we get there, there's some other conditions. I can look at far eastern Brazil. Rainfall patterns there may, in some years, lean toward an El Nino the following year. Haven't seen that developing just yet, but we're not also seeing the opposite. We're not seeing a rainfall pattern that would mean La Nina for next year. It's kind of neutral there. You can look at the Easter Islands, or Easter Island, which is off of Chile. Similar situation. What's the weather doing there now? It can be an indicator for next year. It's holding kind of neutralish, maybe a little La Nina. Then you look at New Zealand, same idea. What's the weather doing there now? It can be an indicator for next year. It's kind of saying, I'm kind of neutral on the topic. So that's why most of my outlook built so far, and again, this may shift after March when we see what the oceans are going to try to do, but is leaning into that neutral territory. There's not a strong indicator in any one direction for next year.
Matt Makins, meteorologist for Cattle Facts. It's Agriculture Today.
Aqua Yield Regional Agronomist Dr. Tracy Carrillo talks about using NanoPro to improve your burn down.
NanoPro is a nanoliquid technology that grabs the molecules of your burn down herbicides. It enhances the delivery of your herbicides, making them more efficient. You oftentimes see a 3-to-1 return on investment. This will stretch your chemical use up to 30%, which means you're saving more money, especially with the availability and volatility of chemicals these days.
Find out more at aquayield.com.
My name is Manuel Macias. My dream was to become a farmer like my grandfather and my dad. It was hard back then. I wanted so bad to buy some land, but no bank will go with me. Until I went to Capital Farm Credit. And as soon as I walked in, I felt the friendliness in it. It's a partnership. It's good to do business with a company that looks out and gives you back whatever you put in. Capital Farm Credit, together we're better.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think one of the lessons that we've had from the pandemic is how you really have a supply chain and each link can be subject to difficulties.
Bill Levy, chief economist at Flexport, speaking at the recent Washington International Trade Association's International Trade Conference.
And we saw that from early on, where it was at the very beginning in the spring of 2020, could you get workers to factories? Were things being swapped? Then could you transport goods from the factories to the ports? Were there planes available or ships to move things from port to port, and then warehousing, trucking, all of these? We've had interruptions that have come because it's hard to get workers. And sometimes that's induced by either the pandemic directly or indirectly. We've had port closures. We've had ships stuck. How does that all, which then begs the question, okay, fine, those are a lot of impediments. What does it all add up to, and how well is the system functioning? I think there's a couple of measures one can look at. The one that's gotten a lot of attention initially was prices, that it just became very expensive. Things where people had assumed that you could move goods relatively cheaply, maybe pay $1,500 to move a container across the Pacific. You were seeing $15,000. So a 10x move in prices. That's certainly one indication of the challenge. The thing that we've put out at Flexport to try and give a direct measure is also a measure of time, which is how long does it take to get from cargo ready at the factory, when it's ready to leave the factory, to when is it picked up from its destination port? And what we have seen is that there has been a very marked increase in the amount of time. And that's actually not just a U.S. thing. We measure it to North America and we measure it to Europe. And in each case, you've seen a dramatic increase. Just to quantify, pre-pandemic, this particular measure would be 40 to 50 days going across the Pacific from Asia to North America. The latest number that we just put out yesterday was 110 days. So, which clearly has an effect. As you say, somebody places an order and wants something to come. You know, how full is the warehouse and how stocked are the shelves?
Penny Noss is president of International Public Affairs and Sustainability with UPS.
I think I'd like to just start with a fact, which is that no U.S. port is in the top 50 globally in terms of productivity. So when you look at the U.S. port system, and not every port is the same, but in general, we can see that the U.S. port infrastructure maybe has not kept up with some of the other global trends that we see out there. So I think our port infrastructure is something that we do need to invest in. And by investing in, it doesn't just mean the hard infrastructure, but also some of the things around digitalization that are now entering into the international trade world. So I think our ports and complement that with infrastructure that needs to be provided in terms of roads and bridges and also airports. That's, I think, a very important thing that we all need to focus on. And I know Sarah mentioned it on the previous panel as well. So I'd like to start with infrastructure, followed by transparency and digitalization. Again, this is something we need to invest in, but what we're seeing around the world is a lot more digitalization being injected into logistics. And again, that is not something that we've always kept up with in the United States. So that's another point I think that we just need to keep an eye on. And then last is the people. And I think Phil referenced it with regards to workers, but we've just been in a very complex environment with regards to labor. And again, supply chains are really driven by people. And I think that we need to think about how you combine some of the issues around people with how we move supply chains around the world if we want to tackle some of these issues.
It's Agriculture Today.
Stock up and save on John Deere filters and packaged oil at the South Plains Implement semi-annual sale. Now through February 28th, receive 10 to 12% off John Deere filters and packaged oil for large ag equipment and 10% off compact tractor home maintenance kits and oil when you purchase filters. No payments, no interest options available on qualifying purchases. Some restrictions apply. See us for details. With 14 locations, there's a South Plains Implement near you. South Plains Implement, where farm meets family.
The formula for success is a simple one. Put strong in, get strong out. That's why cotton growers looking to improve yield potential plant Delta Pine brand cotton, featuring 100 years of proven yield potential and exclusive genetics in every bag. Strong is a legacy all its own. Protect yours with strong cotton from Delta Pine. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Tax policy provides a lot of great job security until it doesn't.
Danielle Beck is Senior Executive Director for Government Affairs for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
You know, 6 months ago when we were all together over in Tennessee, I joked with our membership then that I was going to fight like heck to ensure that our producers weren't having to bear the burden of whatever Build Back Better agenda happened, right? And I'm really thrilled to be here and to be able to say that I've made good on that promise to the best of my ability, right? You know, Congress still has a lot of work to do. There's a lot up in the air, but where U.S. cattle producers are and where all of agriculture and family-owned businesses are, for that matter, today, as opposed to what we were looking at a year ago, are two very different positions. And I think we're in a much better spot now.
On the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act.
TCJA, or the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, was a boon for cattle producers and I think all family-owned business entities across the board. You know, unfortunately, a lot of the relief that was provided under TCJA is not permanent. So I think one of the biggest, most critical provisions in that bill was expansion of the unified credit on the estate tax or the death tax. And so expanded death tax relief. The exclusion limit for an individual went from 5 million to 10 million overnight, and then for couples, 10 to 20. That is tremendously helpful when you're talking about how to transition your family owned business onto the next generation. But we know that that is set to sunset in 2026. And so how do we ensure that all of our family owned businesses can continue on? How can we set our producers up for success, that next generation, to carry on their family's legacy? If you look at inflation, if you look at the cost of everything, rising land values, that relief is needed now more than ever. Luckily, we were able to beat back a very misguided proposal that would have restricted that relief. But we still have more work to do, whether it's permanency on the current TCJA side or looking at other proposals like expanding out that 2032A special use valuation so that it's a relief that's very narrowly targeted to ag and those who need it most.
Talks about the future of the industry.
Lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic. I think it really highlighted just how fragile our beef supply chain is. And if we look towards increasing resiliency, bolstering the U.S. beef supply chain, processing capacity is a core component of that. You know, when you look at the cattle markets and where we are today, I think that increasing competition means an increase in hook space. And we want more players. We want to empower small, mid-sized facilities. And I think they have a really important role to play when it comes to marketing our producers' products. But we also want to ensure that we're setting them up for success in the long term, right? You know, the last thing we want to do is see all of these new facilities come online only for 5 years down the road, them to go belly up and then get scooped up for pennies on the dollar by one of the big four. And so we have been really thrilled to see both the last administration and this administration's attentiveness to processing capacity issues. We have seen several different programs come out of USDA already, and we know that there are several in the works, whether it's guaranteed loans for the expansion of existing facilities, as well as construction of new facilities, grant programs to really set these businesses up for success when it comes to food safety, all of those technical assistance issues, workforce training and development. I think it's going to take a multifaceted approach because there isn't a silver bullet here, right? But we are looking forward to working with USDA because we expect to see newer programs coming out this spring over the summertime, and we know that they've said that this is just the beginning. And so we've got a lot more work to do, but I think it's a bright future and it's going to be a fun project.
It's Agriculture Today.
When your field calls for the perfect type of tough, go all in on FiberMax Cotton to deliver the right seed for whatever you're up against. Like the FiberMax 1621 GL variety. Strong as an ox, fights like a bull. Built to buck stress, boost yield quality, and muscle up when bacterial blight throws down. Whether you're looking for that type of tough or another, you can find it at FiberMax.com. FiberMax Cotton Seed from BASF. Always read and follow label directions.
On the phone with Joe Guzman, Director of Sales for Equinom Smarter Sesame. Joe, 2022's here. You have lots of opportunities in sesame.
That's right, Stephen. We have grain handlers with 2022 agreements ready to be signed. Smarter Sesame makes a great rotational crop for producers who are planning for the new crop and season. With inputs on the rise, Smarter Sesame is a great choice for low input acres.
Joe, if somebody wants to find out more, how can they do that?
They can call 1-833-SESAME or visit equinom.com.
This is Agriculture Today.
We certainly need the help, and we are always an open door. We have a lot of ways to talk to us at USTR, and delighted to have those conversations. I think also we can use some help once we get going here with our trading partners. And I think there's a lot of enthusiasm about having the United States really back engaged heavily in the region, but knowing that the importance from the business community and others really will help us secure some of these agreements.
Deputy U.S. Trade Representative Ambassador Sarah Bianchi.
You know, we're not offering all the traditional market access tools that we have in the past. And so, but I think there's a lot of advantage, whether it's in the digital space or whether it's in competitiveness, there's a lot of advantage for American industry to play a big role here. And we look forward to working with everybody on it.